Hello and welcome to the Home of Medicine podcast with me, Dr. Amy Burbridge. Today I'm joined by
Dr. Ben Lovell. Hello, I'm an acute medicine consultant working in London in the UK.
Fantastic. So Ben, you've got a case for me. So let's get straight in and go to the case.
Brilliant. I've got a really interesting case for you, and I really would like to know what you would have done in this situation, because I think there are many, many paths one could take. And it's about a 35-year-old gentleman who presented to the acute medical take on a doctor strike day, just for context. So the take team consisted of me, another consultant, and a handful of advanced care practitioners. And his presentation was sudden onset palpitations the previous night at 9 p.m. And it was currently 3 p.m. So we're about just over 12, 15 hours maybe after the onset. And the referral was he's in resus at the moment and he's in fast AF on our monitor between 160 and 170 beats a minute. But his blood pressure is good. He has no chest pain, no syncope, no adverse features that would make us worry a little bit. And his past medical history is that this was a very fit and well man who's never had any health problems before. He's never had palpitations before, any heart issues that he's aware of. He did not take any regular medications. He did not drink gallons of coffee or energy drinks a day. He did not drink alcohol to excess. He did not smoke. He did not take any recreational drugs. And his social history was that he works in IT and was a non-smoker. And on examination, I went to resus and found a very well-looking gentleman, 35-year-old gentleman, and the monitor confirmed he was in atrial fibrillation with a very fast rate, about 160 to 170. I love these kind of patients. I love arrhythmias. Not everybody does, but I love them because I feel like you can really make a difference in quite a short time frame, which really satisfies my short attention span, acute medicine, goal-oriented approach to medicine. I like to see results within the time frame of a shift rather than time frame of several months. So I was quite gleeful about going to see this chap. And the ED consultant who'd referred him to me says, we've already tried giving him IV metoprolol, 5 milligrams IV, and we tried some IV flecainide as well. But unfortunately, his rate did not come down and he did not cardiovert chemically. So that's the situation as it stands right now. If I pause there for a sec, can I ask what your opinions are thus far, with particular view to the pharmacological therapy he'd had up to now?
Okay, so you've got a 35-year-old man, normally fit and well, presented with palpitations, sudden started at 9 p.m. the night before. And you were called to see him about 3 p.m. the next day. He was in the resuscitation area of the emergency department. Blood pressure was okay. In fact, he had no adverse features at all. He looked very, very well. My first question, are you sure this is atrial fibrillation? Because atrial fibrillation in a 35-year-old man, it's not the commonest arrhythmia that I would expect to see. So you said you saw it on the monitor. I would really want a 12-lead ECG to see whether am I dealing with atrial fibrillation or am I dealing with supraventricular tachycardia? Because if I am, you said the pharmacological management of metoprolol and flecainide hadn't worked. In AF, you probably expect it to slow down with those medications, whereas I wouldn't with SVT. Now, actually, there are a few things that I'm starting to question now in my head. I'm just going off on a tangent. As I'm talking, I'm thinking. So, number one, am I dealing with AF? Am I dealing with SVT? Have I got the right arrhythmia? Number two, if I think this is atrial fibrillation, I need to be definitely sure of when the atrial fibrillation started before I think about using rhythm control medications. So you mentioned that he was given IV flecainide. You didn't tell me whether he had an echo before he was given the flecainide. And we don't know for certain when the AF started. So we know the palpitation started at 9 p.m, but had he had a background AF for a couple of weeks? And if so, we wouldn't use rhythm control.
So dealing with your questions one at a time, am I sure this is AF and not SVT, supraventricular tachycardia? And of course, when we say SVT, if we were going to be hyper specific, what we meant would be an AV NRT, an AV nodal reentry tachycardia. We all call it SVT. And it's a good question because in my mind, AF usually doesn't get as fast as 170. Usually you see AF from 100 to 150. 150 dead on the money. I
Yeah.
often think, is this atrial flutter with a 2-to-1 conduction? But atrial fib tends not to go that fast. SVT in my mind is when you see the rate going like 170 to 220. It's really, really fast. Of course, SVT is regular, AF is irregular. And one trick you can do at the bedside if you're not sure is by putting them on the pr a printout or on the monitor or a rhythm strip and giving them a little dose of adenosine just to briefly switch off the AV node just for a few seconds. And then you can see what's going on underneath. And I have done that a few times when I'm really not sure. It's not something I do lightly because patients don't like adenosine. Apparently, it feels pretty awful, but you can do it. And I didn't do it in this case because on the 12-lead ECG, I was very certain this was atrial fibrillation. It was irregular. And when the RR interval was slightly longer, you could clearly see fibrillation on the baseline.
Okay.
Pretty sure. Your second question was about an echo beforehand, before chemical cardioversion. What's your reasoning behind that question?
So I guess I was just thinking, if we are certain this is atrial fibrillation, I want to know how long they've had it for. So flecainide, have I got a stable, sorry, not stable, have I got a structurally normal heart that I'm working with? Before I give, I know some of the cardioverting medication can be problematic in structurally abnormal heart. So I'd want to make sure that the heart I was working with is structurally normal.
Yeah, flecainide can be used for chemical cardioversion in patients who have a structurally normal heart. You're exactly right. He hadn't had an echo. The rationale being he's 35, fit and well. It's very unlikely he's going to have a structural heart problem. You're allowed to do that. You're allowed to use the odds and take a bit of risk if you are risk tolerant to that extent. But that was the rationale that was handed over me. Do you know where it came from, by the way, with this real fear with flecainide and structurally abnormal hearts?
No, and it's one of those things that I've had badgered into me for years, but I
Me
don't
too.
know.
Me too. It actually came from something called the Cardiac Arrhythmia Suppression Trial, CAST, CAST, in the late 80s. And it came from a trial where they had this hypothesis that in people who had had an MI, in the weeks and months after an MI, we should try and suppress them from having premature ventricular ectopic beats because that might cause VT. So they tried to suppress asymptomatic ventricular ectopics in MI patients using flecainide, thinking it would decrease the occurrence of VT and mortality. They halted the trial because the mortality went up, and they found that actually the flecainide was actually leading to more cases of VT and sudden cardiac death. And when that signal appeared, they stopped. And that is where this cultural legacy comes from, is a structurally normal heart, structurally normal heart. And what we mean is they don't do it in someone who's post-MI. So when we do that echo first, what we're looking for really are regional wall motion abnormalities indicating a previous infarction and maybe an area of scar on the heart. Scars on the heart and flecainide do not mix, and it can cause someone to move into VT. And that's where this comes from. And he found that out very, very recently. But again, it's been drummed into me. You must get an echo before you go near the flecainide. Echo is not great at picking up previous MI. You can have an MI and still have a structurally normal heart on echo. And also, if you echo someone who's going at 170 beats a minute, what are you actually going to see? I think that's way too fast to make a judgment about ejection fraction, about regional walls and their movement. Even valvulopathies, I think, is difficult to pick up at 170, which is why in general medicine, we like to rate control someone a bit better before we send them for their echo because it gives us more data.
Absolutely.
So I wonder if we drill down to it, if someone is in fast AF, is the echo, I don't know the answer to this, is the echo a valuable test for ruling out structural heart disease before you reach for the flecainide? Or can it give you false reassurance? Or can it give you findings that aren't really there, I guess. I don't know how a reliable a test is in the context of a very, very rapid tachycardia.
Yeah, you've raised a very good point there, actually. You can't, I mean, looking at an echo of somebody who's got a heart rate of 170 beats per minute, you're not going to be able to really properly assess what is going in on that heart at all. And actually, sometimes at that speed, it's really even difficult to auscultate the heart properly. because it's going so fast, let alone actually doing an echo.
Yeah. Do you use Flecainide in your practice much?
Do you know, I can't remember the last time I used it. Genuinely, I mean, when I do advanced live support courses, we say you can use Flecainide as like one of these drugs in the ether that is mentioned, but I cannot genuinely remember the last time I prescribed and gave Flecainide.
Yeah, I
Can
don't
you?
see it much. I don't see. I don't. I have done in people who with new AF, like this chap, who are young and fit and have a very compelling story for recent onset. I have used it, but I think I stopped using it maybe a year or so ago because, anecdotally, I saw that it wasn't working. I didn't have any successful cardioversions, even though the data says that it's supposed to cardiovert AF between 60 and 80% of cases. And I sort of thought, well, it gives me a bit of a, it gives me a bit of a fear to use it because of the legacy of this CAST trial, and it's not working. So let's just bin it. And I noticed that people tend to be much keener to use amiodarone as a tried and tested rhythm control drug. Interestingly, the American Cardiology Society says that the first line should be flecainide as it has a better side effect and mortality profile than amiodarone. So flecainide in a structured normal heart, caveat, is safer than amio. Yeah, I noticed that we tend to prefer amio to flecainide. And I wonder if it's because it isn't such an old drug that we have grown up in our career seeing other people use that we culturally feel it is safer, even though the data suggests otherwise.
And I mean, certainly when I was training, we used much more amiodarone, and we used to use it in peripheral lines as well. I
That's
mean,
smart. Yeah.
you know, and anybody who had fast AF would be given amiodarone. You give a loading dose of 900 milligrams IV over 24 hours, or was it 23 hours or something like that? And then you would give the rest as
Yeah.
a dose, and that would just be normal. That would be what we did.
Yeah. So I wasn't too perturbed by the use of flecainide, and I could see the rationale for using it. And the administration of IV metoprolol as well, it's something we do use a lot in people who are with fast AF. I went off IV metoprolol a while ago because I remember an excellent cardiac physiology consultant telling me when I was doing my cardiology training. Because of course, if you do acute medicine training in the UK, you have to spend some time as a cardiology reg, so you get a good grounding in cardiology. And he said to me, "Why bother giving metoprolol IV? Because the half-life is so short; it's 3 hours. They'll be in fast AF again by the time you all clock off and the shift changes over. Just give them busoprolol. The onset's really, really fast. The half-life is way longer; it's like 13 hours or something, and you don't have to keep chasing the rate for the rest of the 24-hour period until they get seen the next day." So I made a sort of shift personally. If someone comes in fast AF, if they're hemodynamically stable, I now load them with 2.5 bisoprolol. Then I top that up a bit more later in the shift if they've slowed down, but not to my satisfaction. But I still see IV metoprolol being given at the front door. The rationale sometimes has been explained to me is I just want to check if they're beta blocker responsive before I give them anything longer. And I don't know if that's scientific or if that is sort of a cultural thing which has crept in over the years. But what do you do?
Now, anecdotally, I mean, we see huge numbers of patients in fast AF, and we use bisoprolol because, like you say, for the reasons it's oral, it's quick acting, and it's got that good half-life. However, anecdotally, and patients that I've seen in who bisoprolol hasn't worked immediately, and we try some IV metoprolol, we often get a response from the IV metoprolol. And again, I don't know whether that's anything physiological or it's just one of those things that happens. But we do often find that, okay, bisoprolol hasn't worked, and maybe it hasn't worked because they've got, you know, a gut problem and they can't absorb the bisoprolol. So maybe, you know, there is a role for intravenous beta blockade if the patient can't absorb properly, potentially.
Fair enough.
But it's not something, again, I can't remember the last time I used IV metoprolol either, because usually bisoprolol, oral bisoprolol, works really effectively. The only thing I'm going to query, I mean, I guess if you've tried the metoprolol, you've tried the flecainide. Was there any, you didn't mention bisoprolol, so they haven't gone down the oral bisoprolol route. Okay. Are you definitely sure of the onset of action of this atrial fibrillation? I'm faffing. I'm just worrying now about this clot sitting in the heart, ready to just be thrown off and cause a stroke, which is probably not going to happen, but.
Well, it is a real fear, because cardioversion from someone who has been in AF for longer than 40 hours, if they could have got even a microclot in the left atrial appendage, it can move. It can move north and cause a stroke. So this was something I kept coming back to with the patient, saying, "Are you sure? Tell me, what were you doing the moment it came on? How did you notice you had palpitations? And you've never had this before, never." I tried to make it as clear and black and white as possible, but he was a good historian. He said, I was doing nothing, and then, oof, something weird in my chest, and I felt it was leaping and jumping a little bit, and then I thought it might go away, and it didn't go away, and I've come in." So he gave a really, really good story. We say a lot on this podcast, listen to the patient, they are telling you the diagnosis. And that's something we like when it suits our narrative. Women are really, really frightened, sometimes be like, "Well, I don't know if you're telling me the diagnosis." But I think in this case, he really, really was. So I went to see this patient. He'd had some attempts at chemical cardioversion, an attempt at chemical rate control, and he was still going very fast. And the ED consultant who made the referral to me came up and he said, "What do you think? He's had a really good onset. Shall we do it? Should we cardiovert him? DC cardioversion?" And I said, and I thought about it, went, "Yeah, let's do it." Would you have done it?
Oh, so I'm just trying to think about practically how I'd work through this case. So, when I'm stuck and I need time to think, which often happens, my brain doesn't work as quick as it probably did 10 years ago. I'm like, okay, so let's go down A to E and I'll speak this out. So, it's really what I'm doing is I'm having time in my head. So, he's sitting up, he's chatting, he's breathing, his respiratory rate's fine, saturation's fine, blood pressure's fine, everything's absolutely fine. You're thinking about cardioverting, electrical cardioverting somebody who is hemodynamically stable. Could you, why wouldn't you go for amiodarone? Why would you go for electrical cardioversion?
So the rationale was, we could give amiodarone.
Mm-hmm.
Guidelines say that if you have a good story about onset, then DC cardioversion is a very safe and very effective treatment. Amiodarone, as I mentioned before, is mostly very well tolerated. It's less effective and it has a plethora of side effects, which can be deeply unpleasant for a young person. I think we both agreed that rhythm control would be a superior plan in this patient than rate control. He's 35. He doesn't want to be in AF for the rest of his life, taking medications and such like. And we could, I think, what would we do if we didn't rhythm control him now? He'd probably end up on a DOAC for 6 weeks and have an outpatient electrocardioversion, right? Or an ablation. We could cut out those 6 weeks of misery by doing a very well-established guideline pathway in emergency and acute medicine, which is aborting a recent onset of a tachyarrhythmia in a very safe way. And I thought, risks and benefits, it seems pretty straightforward. I said, "Who would do the anaesthetic?" The ED consultant said, "I will," because ED consultants are very well-trained professionals with an absolute multitude of skills, including rapid sequence induction, etc., or mild sedation for a procedure like this. So he said, "Yeah, I'll do it. No worries. Bit of propofol, bit of midazolam. He hasn't eaten for 6 hours. If you want to press the buttons." And I thought, "Yeah, I do want to press the buttons, actually." I was kicking myself because DC cardioversion is a mandatory skill for internal medicine trainees to achieve on a yearly basis, a part of their curriculum. It was a strike day. What are the odds? Not a single trainee around to get this signed off. I could have maybe got two or three of them signed off, or we all did it as a thinking group at the same time. So I thought, well, what, that's rotten luck. But I thought, yeah, we'll do it now. We could get him in sinus rhythm in 10 minutes' time. I'll admit him to my monitored bed overnight, get an echo in the morning and a cardio review, and we can discharge him with an outpatient plan. Of course, you've got to involve the patient. So I thought, well, I'll go and tell the patient what we're thinking about doing. So I went to the patient and said, "You're in a very fast rhythm. It's a very common rhythm. It isn't dangerous, but it's a rhythm we more commonly see in older adults. It's very unusual to see in young patients. And usually in young patients, it indicates just a little bit of miswiring in the circuit board that is your heart, which will be completely treatable. We don't like to leave people in this fast rhythm for a long period of time, because when the heart is racing at 170 beats a minute, eventually it'll get tired. So we always think about slowing it down, or even better, putting you back into a normal rhythm again. And here's how we can do this. We've tried a drug, it didn't work. We tried a drug to slow it down, it didn't work. The next stage would be to quickly reset the heart, reset that electrical rhythm, and put you back into a normal sinus rhythm. So I went through it with him. I said the risks of doing it and the risks of not doing it. And we agreed to proceed to do the DC cardio version. So I quoted him the following risks. I said, risks of local mild burn or redness to the skin is quite common, but it fades after a few hours, like a little bit of sunburn. The risk of failure in not working, I said 10 to 20%. And I quoted him a risk of stroke of 1%. And I did that based on a recent trial, which I read in, where did I read it? In one of the American journals. I think it was in JAMA. And they said, what is the true risk of stroke in DC, in this exact instance, DC cardioversion, someone with new onset AF? And it was about 1%. Actually, it was about 0.7%, so less than 1%. But they found out there's a 12-hour rule. If you DC cardio at someone within 12 hours of their symptoms onset, the risk of a stroke is 0.3, very low. If it's over 12 hours, the risk goes up to 1.1%. When I was having this conversation with him, it was at 16 hours. So I quoted him 1% risk of stroke. And of course, the risks the risks of any sedation, which should be aspiration, etc., or a reaction to the medication. And we proceeded, and it went beautifully. Bit of propofol on the monitor, synchronize. One, charge him up to 100 joules. Everyone stand clear, charging, shocking. He went straight back into sinus rhythm, woke up 5 minutes later in sinus rhythm, and he was discharged the next day in sinus rhythm. And it's very satisfying to do. And I think it was quite satisfying from a patient's point of view because he went in with a problem which we cured for him essentially. And then, now he'll go and he'll see a cardiologist, an outpatient, and he'll have some kind of electrophysiology testing, and see if he's a candidate for any kind of ablation process. So that was the case. One little thing I would just say, if you are doing this, I always prepare the patient, but I always prepare the team around as well. Because I think what a lot of people have never seen it before, and goodness me, you should have seen the crowd it drew. All the doctors and the nurses who were on the floor at that moment wanted to come and watch, which is fine, as long as you weren't in the way. But I just say, just so you know, when you shock a patient, even though they can be very heavily sedated, it's very common for them to suddenly shout, oh, throw their arm in the air, or jump briefly up the bed and open their eyes. That's normal, and then they go back to sleep again afterwards, and they won't remember it. But I always prepare the people around because they can get the fright of their life when that actually happens. In the last few times I've done it, so there we go. Do you think I was too brave? Would you have done?
Gosh, do you know, I think it was it's an incredible case. I think you did absolutely 100% the right thing. I'm not sure I would have done the same thing because of my anxieties about stroke, which is crazy, and I don't know where it's come from. However, you're right, in this case, synchronized DC cardioversion was the right thing to do, much safer than amiodarone, sending him home on a DOAC for 6 weeks, where he then has an outpatient cardioversion. It was absolutely the right thing to do. And you did it in a very safe, controlled environment with the right staff around, with the right, and the patient had been involved in that patient-centered decision making as well. And that's what they wanted to do. So it was a great case. Couple of questions I've got is he's very young to have atrial fibrillation. So I'd want to think about what caused it. What caused this man at 35 years old to go into fast AF at 9 p.m.? And I guess that's what we start to think about in the outpatient appointment and how we'd manage it. But things I'd want to be thinking about during the on-call are, you mentioned no alcohol, no illicit medication use. I'd want to think about family history, thyroid function tests. Is he hyperthyroid? Does he have any other endocrine abnormalities? Does he have any structural heart abnormalities? Does he have a valvular heart problem? Has he got a lung problem? Does he have a PE? Sometimes having a PE can flip people into AF at this age. Again, seems very unlikely. So those are the sort of things I'd probably be going through in my head. What role do you think, as acute physicians, we have in identifying the cause of the AF in an acute setting?
I think we have an absolute responsibility to do so. I think it depends on the department you work in. Acute medicine, we meet people at the front door, but I do know acute medicine services at other hospitals where they follow up patients in general clinics. One example I'm thinking of is a venous thromboembolism. If you diagnose someone with a PE or a DVT in acute medicine, we have the responsibility to make the diagnosis. But I think we also have the responsibility to say, why did you have a clot? Why do you have a clot? You know, what were your risk factors? It decides whether or not that we give you, 3 or 6 months of anticoagulation. But is there an underlying cause which needs to be addressed? And that's why we have guidelines saying if someone's over the age of 50, then we should do a chest X-ray and we should look for a hidden malignancy. And if someone's a bit younger, we think about things like thrombophilias. But I think that we, a surface level, sometimes being completely honest, all you can manage is a surface level diagnosis and treatment. Here's your clot, here's your blood thinners. That's all we can manage because our service is so stretched. And I have worked in some insanely busy DGHs. People call it firefighting, where you can only do surface level investigations and treatments. But hopefully we have more opportunity as our specialty grows to do a deeper dive and say, but why? So to answer your question, why did he go to AF at 9 p.m. the day before? My working diagnosis is that he had a predisposing factor, which I talk about as a loose wiring when I'm talking to patients, or a slightly errant bit of wiring on their circuit board in their heart, which just caused a bit of a short circuit. So I think he had a predisposing factor, and then on top of that, a triggering factor. That meant that at that exact moment, that's why finally he went into AF. I guess you could say that if you think he had an underlying electrophysiological problem, then how do you know he wasn't having little subclinical AFs before then and developing, a small microclot in the LA or something like that? But I went on his history. I think that we have the responsibility to make the initial diagnosis, to think a little deeper, and ensure we have robust follow-up plans. I think that is our responsibility.
And I think the reason I'm thinking of all these questions now is because I'm sitting here doing a podcast with yourself. However, when I'm in A&E resus, my main priority is going to be to make that patient safe, which is exactly what you did. And I haven't cardioverted anybody for years. Like, I can't remember the last time I did it.
Well, there are.
So.
Thinking about it, I was saying, oh, I can't believe what are the odds, the sheer odds that this would happen on the one day that we didn't have the junior doctors here who need to get this done, this skill learn. But I thought, actually, it might not be to do with the sheer bad luck, because I think that if it wasn't a strike day and that shift had been staffed by its usual complement of trainees, they wouldn't have cardioverted either for the reasons that you said. Unfamiliarity with the procedure, which is quite a big deal to do. Their risk tolerance being a different place in the spectrum compared to mine. They may not have had the consultant supervision and the presence to give the appropriate support, to give the sedation. So in fact, I think if that patient had turned up on a non-strike day, probably it wouldn't have resulted in a cardioversion either, simply because he would have encountered doctors, excellent doctors, very well-trained doctors, but simply had not had enough experience of urgent DC cardioversion to feel that was a safe practice to do in the resus department. Whereas I have a few of them under my belt. I teach the skill regularly on simulation courses, and it was something I felt was well within my skill set to do safely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if it would have been me, I may not have cardioverted, to be honest, because I haven't done one for a long time. So although I teach it on advanced life support courses, you teach it, but it's not the same as doing it practically. And I probably would have gone down a different route, maybe. I don't know. At the time, when you're in that ED resuscitation area, the way that you think and the things that you do are often very different to what you do. For example, what I'm thinking I'll do now. So it's, yeah, the situation and the environment that we were in when we are presented a case massively affects how we deal with that situation. So if I'm presented a case and I'm sitting in the same day emergency care unit and I've got a 30-minute slot to see a patient, the way that I deal with that patient will be very different to if I've got 2 minutes to make a very quick decision in the resuscitation area. So I do sometimes think the environment also changes how I deal with situations. Whether that's, I don't know whether that's a right thing or a wrong thing. I think that's just life in a very busy clinical environment.
I think it's a human thing. It's about availability of resources. I had a colleague who was saying,
Of course.
I can do this. If I didn't, would I?
Yes.
Okay, I'm now going to pursue this plan. Let's get hold of on-call anaesthetists. They'll probably want it done faster. They'll probably want it done in theatres or somewhere like that. And they probably want to come and do an anaesthetic assessment first. Oof, that's a lot of steps. I'll tell you what, let's just park him on a monitored bed tonight, get the rate under control, and we'll make a plan in daylight hours. And the availability of your resources to you wildly affect the plans that you make, which is a very big deal in ergonomics and human factors, saying, is it fair that patients really get completely different treatment depending on where they happen to pitch up? People talk about postcode lotteries, whether you turn up in a place with this out-of-hour service and this place that doesn't have an out-of-hour service. But of course, we only operate within the resources and the structures that we actually have. So the fact that I had availability to do a procedure meant that I cracked on and did it. But that patient probably would have had a very different outcome if the resources had been mixed up a little bit.
And also, I noticed going along with the human factors, ergonomic side of things, if you see me at 9 a.m. in the morning and I've started my shift, or you see me at 10 to 9 in the evening when I'm just about to enter my 13th hour of work, I struggle. I struggle to make decisions. I have decision fatigue. I have physical fatigue because I probably haven't eaten properly. I probably haven't been to the bathroom as often as I should. I probably haven't drank enough. So my ability to function as a doctor is different, and I'm aware of that. And actually, if this was 9 o'clock at night, I probably would have said, I'll keep you in overnight, we'll monitor, we'll try and rate control, and we'll make a plan in the morning.
Yeah, I think that's very honest and I think that's very universal. We mentioned it on this podcast before. The doctor that patients see in the first hour of your shift and the doctor the patient they see in the last hour shift are two different doctors. And, you know, since I've been practicing medicine and since yourself as well, the changes to doctors' working hours and the contracts have been some real positives. Do you remember when you used to do 7 night shifts in a row?
Oh gosh, I
By
do.
the time, yeah, by
It
the time
was so bad.
the sixth and seventh night shift, myself, and I think it was common, doctors, you are making clinical decisions based on your internal mental landscape rather than what is best for this patient in front of you. And I think the fact they nailed that, they got rid of it. And do you remember the 12 consecutive days we used to do, or the 5 consecutive 13-hour shifts? The fact that those have been legislated against, I think, is profoundly positive. And it's one positive thing I've seen in training since I've been in practice, because it means that patients are not encountering doctors who simply cannot physically make a decision anymore because they've been pushed the limit of human endurance. I'm not saying that the hours worked by trainee doctors now are easy by any measure, but I think that was one step made since I've been practicing medicine towards patient safety and doctor safety, which I think has been positive.
I mean, I remember as a first year doctor, we would do 7 nights in a row. You'd finish on the Friday morning, then on the Monday, you'd start a 12-day stretch, which is bonkers. And my first ever set of nights, my body didn't know what to do. So I finished on the Friday morning. I remember driving home to my parents' house, parking my car on their drive, being woken up a couple of hours later, and my car was in the middle of the road because I'd forgot to put the handbrake on. And the person knocked on the door and was like, your car's in the middle of the road. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And I think he must have thought, she's just asleep in the day. What is she doing? You know, she's clearly a waste of space. But I don't even know how I drove home. I mean, I was literally on autopilot. It's really, really scary. And I didn't know how to sleep because I'd been up. I was nocturnal completely. And I know people still do a lot of night shifts now. They don't see me. And I think the older I get, the less my body can deal with them. I think in my 20s, I was much better. In my 40s, it's not a
Completely
good
the
thing.
same. I get jet lag when they change the time, when the hours go back. Yeah, one hour.
The
I don't know what's going on. Yeah, and just to emphasize, neither of us are saying that it's easy now.
No, God, no.
There's still a
Absolutely
lot
not.
of horrible incidents, people driving after night shifts, which are terrifying, but at least it's been recognized as an issue. We sound pretty ancient, Amy. Back in my day, we
I
sound.
can add. I mean, there is so, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not right for anybody at the moment, I don't think. I think, you know, there are how we practice, and there are many issues across the whole board, and I think it's how we try and navigate that. And all I do now at the moment to try and stay afloat is to go to work, do the best job I possibly can with each patient at that moment in time. So if it is 8 p.m. at night, what's the best I can do with my physical resources at that time?
What a lovely comment to wrap up the conversation on.
Always do our best. Fabulous. Thank you so much for that, Ben. That was a really, really interesting case. And I still don't know how I'd manage it. And I think that's what's the beauty of medicine, is that we all do think and do things differently, because ultimately medicine is an art, not a science. That's. So thank you so much, Ben. Thank you to everybody for listening to that podcast, and we'll be back soon. Goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Home of Medicine podcast, a podcast brought to you by the EFIM Academy in association with the European Federation of Internal Medicine, a leading organisation in internal medicine. Thanks for listening.